He's prepared to act against many Chinese companies unless the Chinese do a better job of policing up the sanctions themselves.
North Korea discussion dominates attention. It's Tuesday, April 4th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well online right now at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, Myanmar elections show growing pains and strains. Water flows toward conflict in Pakistan, keeping wheat healthy. And virtual tours of the past. We keep it real right now on VOA Asia. Just days before his first summit with China's President Xi Jinping, President Donald Trump told the Financial Times on Sunday the United States is prepared to take unilateral action to eliminate the nuclear threat posed by North Korea if China does not increase pressure on its Asian ally. Mr. Trump said China has great influence over North Korea, and if they help, it would be very good for Beijing. If not, he added, it won't be good for anyone. An administration policy review on North Korea is reportedly complete and is said to include sanctions to cut Pyongyang out of the global financial system, including secondary penalties aimed at Chinese banks and companies. The U.S. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley made similar comments about China in appearances Sunday on U.S. television.
China has to cooperate. This is now down to, do we want to continue to see these ballistic missile attacks from North Korea, or does China want to do something about it? And this is all about the fact that they need to have action. And we're going to continue to put pressure on China to have action. That will be shown in multiple ways. But what we are going to do is say, China, you know that you're the only one that's doing this. We appreciate that you stopped coal going into North Korea, but we know it's going in other ways. At some point, we need to see definitive actions by China condemning North Korea and not just calling them out for it.
Her comments come amid reports Pyongyang is about to conduct its sixth nuclear test. RAND Corporation analyst Bruce Bennett tells VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Trump's remarks represent a change in policy from the previous Obama administration.
The Obama administration has had the opportunity to do secondary sanctions against Chinese businesses working with North Korea for a year roughly now, and only acted, as I understand it, against one Chinese company. I think President Trump is now saying that he's prepared to act against many Chinese companies unless the Chinese do a better job of policing up the sanctions themselves. And we know that the Chinese have not. The Chinese declared a coal import cutoff from North Korea in February, and since that time, there have been many reports of ships pulling into Chinese ports with coal on them from North Korea. So China's not been doing a very good job of policing the sanctions.
As you know, China has indicated it has very little leverage on North Korea.
Well, it has very little leverage if it's unwilling to apply it, which is part of the problem. Now, we don't know the extent to which that is the government telling people to do something, but then bribery getting the importers around it, or what's causing the difficulty. But we know that trade is still flowing in areas that are supposed to be prohibited, according to the Chinese government, and they haven't taken that action yet. And that doesn't mean they will stop North Korea's missile launches, but it will certainly hurt North Korea if they do.
The comments by Mr. Trump to the Financial Times come as Reuters reports that his national security aides have completed a policy review on North Korea that may mix military activity with heightened sanctions that may also incorporate targets against Chinese banks and businesses that do most business with Pyongyang.
So the latter part, the banks and the businesses in China, would be the secondary sanctions. So according to the congressional action taken last year, if companies in China do business with North Korea, then we can tell them that they are not allowed to do business with the United States. So they have to choose between the U.S. and North Korea. That's probably going to be pretty compelling to many Chinese banks and companies to cut off their activity with North Korea, but the president has to specifically designate them.
Bruce Bennett said while China does not react well to pressure, it may have already discussed the tougher sanctions with the U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who spoke by telephone Sunday with Chinese State Counselor Yang Jiechi about the summit and issues of bilateral and regional importance. Stay with VOA Asia, as we'll hear in just a moment from a ranking member of Congress about details of measures aimed at North Korea's nuclear and missile threats. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Trump's North Korea comments raise speculation about China president's visit. Japan envoy recalled over statue flap to return to South Korea. Despite crackdown, survey indicates corruption is still a challenge in Asia. Dalai Lama and border guard who escorted him into India have emotional reunion. North Korea free to take part in 2018 games, says Seoul. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. As we continue with VOA Asia, Republican Congressman Ed Royce from California, who is chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee, tells our VOA Korean reporters about specific measures and new economic sanctions that are being taken to address growing threats from North Korea.
One of the things we were focused on is the way in which this new UN report, which was made available last month, says that North Korea is using increasingly sophisticated tactics to evade existing sanctions. And they have done this by using networks of middlemen and banks, and they're succeeding in moving money and people and arms and material across borders. And in the meantime, they continue to find ways to get hard currency into the country, and they use that hard currency, of course, on their nuclear weapons program. So the UN report says that sanctions enforcement from other nations remains insufficient. So we're looking at ways to expand the sanctions to target front companies and enablers and to vastly expand the administration's authority to use sanctions to address this emerging North Korean threat, including the cyber thefts that we have seen. And we do that by targeting those overseas who employ North Korean slave labor, which is a source of billions of dollars in annual revenue for the regime, and the types of activities you've identified. And we crack down on North Korean shipping and the use of international ports.
H.R. 1644 also bans North Korea from dollar transactions and completely cuts the country out of the U.S. financial system. How much will this measure hurt the North Korean regime?
Well, what it will do is cut off much of the funding that North Korea right now uses for its nuclear weapons program. So the key is that it attempts to prevent North Korea from moving forward with what our new satellite images show is the ongoing evolution of preparation for nuclear tests, as well as advancements in their ICBM program and their miniaturization of a nuclear weapon so that they can put it on these missiles and on these ICBMs. That is the goal there, and to cut off the currency that's used for that purpose. I would add one other thing to this. Also, the legislation which we passed yesterday condemns North Korea's development of intercontinental ballistic missiles and requires the U.S. State Department to determine whether North Korea should be relisted as a state sponsor of terrorism. This is particularly urgent in the wake of the recent widely reported assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother. We feel that strengthening U.S. sanctions targeting the North Korean regime's weapons programs and human rights abuses is very important.
Our thanks to Congressman Ed Royce and to the VOA Korean Service for bringing us this interview. Happening now in Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump told the Financial Times if China wasn't going to solve the problem of North Korea, his administration would. Chinese President Xi Jinping meets with Trump Thursday, and North Korea is expected to be discussed. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. always thrilled when you're able to join us for VOA Asia. Thanks so much for listening. Myanmar's ruling National League for Democracy, or NLD, won nearly half of the 19 national and regional parliamentary seats that were contested Sunday in by-elections. It was the first vote since the party of Aung San Suu Kyi swept to power in late 2015. The NLD did experience a drop-off in support among ethnic minorities at the regional level. The military-backed Union Solidarity and Development Party continues to lose popular support, capturing just one lower house seat and a state assembly seat. Vikram Nehru is a senior associate with the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he tells VOA it's clear why the NLD did not do as well in ethnic areas as it did 2 years ago.
In the earlier elections, that is the one in 2015, the NLD had developed coalitions with many of the ethnic parties in order to beat the USDP. But now that the USDP is a shadow of its former self, there was no need for that coalition. And so there was a genuine political contest between the ethnic parties and the NLD. And in most of these ethnic states where there were seats in state parliaments, the NLD didn't win. The ethnic parties won. That's to be expected. The other point that I want to make is that many people have said in this election that this was a vote against the NLD's sort of relative lack of progress as far as policy reforms are concerned. And I'm not sure I would agree with that. I think there is still considerable support for the policies of the NLD. The NLD has not really put a foot wrong as far as economic policies are concerned and most political policies are concerned. And that's quite impressive considering the fact that the NLD was not used to governing, was an opposition party. The fact that they haven't made any silly mistakes is quite impressive. And I think under the surface, they have made quite a lot of progress. I don't think the NLD has done badly at all. On the economic front, for example, there is criticism from the international community that she hasn't made much progress on economic reforms. But that's just not true. She has made progress on economic reforms, except that they have been under-the-surface reforms, reforms which don't normally catch the public eye, but which are gradually putting in place a governance infrastructure for future reforms. One has to give credit where credit is due, and she has to be given more credit than she's been given, and more credit than she's giving herself.
Vikram Nehru said while the unrest involving the Muslim Rohingya minority in Rakhine State has tarnished Aung San Suu Kyi's reputation internationally, it has not necessarily done so domestically. He said it underscores the limited authority of the civilian government over the military, which remains in charge of security operations. He said Myanmar is really a nation with two governments, one civilian, the other military. Steve Sanford is in Shan State and has more on Aung San Suu Kyi's eroding minority support.
Ethnic voters in Myanmar helped Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, or NLD, sweep into power last April following a historic election. Groups like the ethnic Karen, who suffered decades of alleged abuse by the former military regime, had high hopes for a restoration of stability and growth. But with continued fighting primarily in the ethnic areas, NLD supporters question where their leaders' interests lie.
She's a triumph, but the last time is that she's working with military too. The second thing is the Aung San Suu Kyi is Burmese. Burmese is working for Burmese.
The NLD, however, holds a different outlook on the increased conflicts in Myanmar.
Our first priority is to develop economically and socially those regions, the Saharawi regions, ethnic regions. That is our first priority. And so these problems is already linked with these peace problems.
Only one armed group with substantial military forces signed the National Ceasefire Agreement before the elections. But since then, the Shan State Army South has been seen as a proxy force for the government to attack smaller ethnic groups who've yet to sign the agreement. With the emerging international business interests at stake, activists say the local ethnic communities are being excluded from the benefits.
As the ethnic point of view, we had voted for her, but she did not care or have interest for us. And this is not fair, because we have high hope on Aung San Suu Kyi to be our voice, but she keeps silent.
Since the new government's first official peace talks last August, fighting has actually intensified in ethnic areas of the country. And now, watchdog groups like Human Rights Watch are calling Aung San Suu Kyi to step up and support investigations of massive abuse in Rakhine State where tens of thousands of Muslim Rohingya have fled the country since last October. Human Rights Watch's Phil Robertson spoke with VOA via Skype.
Aung San Suu Kyi has to be quite clear with the fact-finding commission that she supports their mission. She supports the effort to try to find out who has committed human rights abuses in Northern Rakhine State. It would be a major mistake on her part to step up and try to defend the military's actions in Northern Rakhine State, to try to push back on the fact-finding commission as some sort of interference in internal affairs of Burma.
As pressure mounts on Aung San Suu Kyi's government to protect the ethnic groups, time will tell whether her supporters remain behind her. Steve Sanford reporting for VOA from Shan State, Myanmar.
And we take you to Shan State with video from Steve's report exclusively on our VOA Asia Facebook page and the VOAnews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Japan announced its envoy will return to South Korea. Japan recalled its envoy and canceled economic talks over the installation of a comfort woman statue near its consulate in Busan. Japan said the political flux in South Korea meant an ambassador needed to be in place to maintain ties. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, Pakistan is mostly in the news because of its problems with violent extremism. Experts, however, say an even bigger problem plagues the country, one that can lead to violent conflicts or food insecurity. That problem is an acute water shortage. VOA's Aisha Tanzim has more.
Drilling for water, especially for personal use, used to be an exception. It is now the norm, even in major cities like the capital, Islamabad. Pakistan is facing a water shortage that some experts are calling disastrous, even apocalyptic. A country that started off as a water affluent nation in 1947 is now on the verge of becoming water stressed, mainly due to an explosive growth in population, which now stands at an estimated 190 million people. The additional population requires additional food. More than 90% of Pakistan's water resources are used in agriculture. But experts say the crops Pakistan grows, mainly wheat, rice and sugarcane, are all water-intensive and the wrong choice for its agrarian economy.
There is absolutely no justification in Pakistan for sugarcane. Because sugarcane, you know, sugarcane is like trees. It's like growing forests. The amount of water consumed by that and the rate of recovery, the amount of sugar that you get out of a liter of sugarcane juice in Pakistan is the lowest in the world.
The irrigation system built to transport water for agriculture is not lined, so up to 40% of the water is wasted during transmission. Meanwhile, the country has not raised its water storage capacity in several decades.
You get 145 million acre feet of water throughout the year in your rivers. 70 to 80% of that water comes during 70 days of monsoon, July, August, and 10 days of September. If you don't have the capacity to store that water for the rest of the 295 days, you will always be in trouble.
The available storage capacity is also depleting due to silting. Farmers and others are making up for the shortfall by extracting water from the ground. The result is a lowering of groundwater levels with serious long-term consequences.
Many experts, including those working for the government, say business as usual will surely lead to a crisis. The issue still does not seem to be one of the top priorities for the government. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
The Developing at this hour in Asia, a lawyer for a man facing extradition to China on murder charges told New Zealand's High Court the government could not rely on assurances the man would not be tortured or receive the death penalty. Australia recently scrapped a vote to ratify its own extradition treaty. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, cereals such as wheat and barley are important food plants, and they're grown almost everywhere in the world. But they're susceptible to diseases, and one of the most damaging is a fungal pathogen that causes the dreaded wheat head blight or wheat scab. VOA's George Puditch reports by using modern gene editing techniques, scientists at the University of Maryland have discovered a new and effective way to fight the disease.
Maryland University's assistant professor Nidhi Rawat inoculates spikes of wheat plants with a suspension containing spores of Fusarium graminearum, a highly toxic fungus whose varieties attack many food crops and causes wheat scab.
Here we are testing some plants that we know genetically that they have the resistance gene in them, FHB1 gene. But we are actually evaluating them, how good is their resistance.
For more than 20 years, scientists have been using conventional techniques to breed crops resistant to Fusarium. But this time-consuming process had limited success. Chemical pesticides are also only partially effective. Using the latest gene editing technology, researchers from University of Maryland, Kansas State University, and University of Minnesota, Notre Dame, managed to decipher the DNA sequence of a gene called FHB1, which provides high resistance to the fungal pathogen.
With this gene information now, they can select only for the varieties which have FHB1. And in fact, the gene information can also be used to combine with other sources of resistance with marker-assisted selection. So they can have a high level of resistance, and that will obviously lead to lower levels of toxins associated with them.
Every year, farmers around the world lose millions of dollars because even if one part per million of the Fusarium toxin is found in a crop, it is unacceptable for human or even animal consumption. Scientists hope this new technique will finally lead to the spread of new breeds of wheat plants, highly resistant to the damaging fungus. George Puttich, VOA News, Washington.
A German software company has used drones and laser imaging to take people back in time to the ancient city of Volterra in Italy. The goal of this project is to save historically significant places in cyberspace as time continues to slowly wear them down. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
The historic Tuscan city of Volterra is an amazing mashup of Roman, Etruscan, and medieval architecture. To ensure that history doesn't disappear, the city was painstakingly mapped using all manner of imaging technology.
The entire town has been captured because we could make use of various technologies, drones, scanners. So it was not really a big problem or a big challenge. We were able to link those data with geodata, so the city really could have a physical connection.
The result is an incredibly realistic depiction of a town that has a 3,000-year history.
The 3D model that we have created does not only convey graphical information, but also all information necessary for further processing of the data. Pictorial material, state, cultural, historical contexts, architectural style, and so forth.
The goal of all this work is to provide a permanent record for anyone interested in seeing the town in its heyday.
With all those excessively collected data, we were able to create a consolidated model which is accessible for experts as well as laymen.
Experts such as researchers or architects, if time or an earthquake were to devastate parts of the city as it has in the past. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
And perhaps that technology will be used somewhere near where you live. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Steve Miller and Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.